We're going to examine Mitterrand's political pedigree. We're going to ruminate ever so briefly about some of the implications of Mitterrand's fascist collaborationist past. But beyond that, we're going to take a look at, in a protracted way, at the fascist milieu of which François Mitterrand was a part. Because in examining the French fascist movements of the 1930s, their role in attempting to overthrow the socialist coalition government of Léon Blum, the Popular Front of Léon Blum, and their later collaboration with German fascism and helping to subvert the very country of which they were citizens, the milieu of which François Mitterrand was a part is illustrative and exemplary of the clandestine, cellular operational organization of fascism, which has to a large extent permitted fascism not only to operate successfully outside of the view, the political gaze of many of those who ultimately were to fall victim to it, but beyond that, the clandestine cellular organization and operation of fascism, German Nazism in particular, is one of the things that has kept it out of the history books to a certain extent. It is one of the reasons why Johnny and Janie can't identify Il Duce, because to a large extent, fascism and German fascism in particular has operated clandestinely. And the milieu of which François Mitterrand is a part will go to a large extent to illustrate not only how that clandestine cellular organizational structure functions, but also how the German Nazis were able to manipulate anti-communism in a strategic manner in order to effect the conquest of some of the nations that they ultimately were able to subjugate. The following story is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Saturday, September 3rd of 1994. This story is by Marilyn August of the Associated Press. It's headlined, Veil Raised on Mitterrand's Tie to Wartime Nazi Collaborators, and it reads in part, Shrouded in half-truths and rumors for nearly a half-century, President François Mitterrand's role in the pro-Nazi Vichy regime during World War II has been brought to light in a widely acclaimed book published this week. Une Jeunesse Française, A French Youth, a 616-page work by investigative reporter Pierre Payan, P-E-A-N, answers many questions Mitterrand never wanted to confront. Previous biographies on the president have skimmed over the war years, concentrating on his childhood and rise in the Socialist Party starting in the mid-1950s. Working from archives, tracking down lost photos, letters, and previously unpublished documents, Payan managed to piece together the Mitterrand enigma. And then came the unexpected. When confronted with Payan's findings, Mitterrand threw open his personal archives and cooperated fully. Yes, the young Mitterrand was an ardent follower of collaborationist leader Philippe Pétain and believed in the, quote, national revolution, unquote, that begat the strict anti-Jewish laws of 1940 and 41. As early as 1935, Mitterrand participated in an anti-foreigner rally in Paris. After the French defeat of 1940, Mitterrand joined the ultranationalist Légion des Jeunes Combattants, Fighters Legion, which later became the feared militia that relentlessly hunted Jews and resistance fighters. Yes, Mitterrand had close ties with La Cagoule, an outlawed extreme right-wing group that sought to overthrow the Republic, and yes, he never repudiated his friendship with some of its leaders. By the way, remember in particular the Cagoule. We're going to come back to the Cagoule in just a minute, because the Cagoule, along with other French fascist groups, attempted to overthrow the legitimate, democratically elected government of France in 1937 and 38, and those same frustrated would-be coup makers later collaborated actively with the German invaders in order to subvert France and to effect the conquest of France by Germany. They basically became fifth columnists. So remember here, and going back once again, yes, Mitterrand had close ties with La Cagoule, C-A-G-O-U-L-E, an outlawed, extreme right group that sought to overthrow the Republic, and yes, he never repudiated his friendships with some of its leaders. At 26, Mitterrand also received the Francisque, Vichy's highest award from Pétain. He published articles in Pétainist magazines that also carried rabidly anti-Semitic diatribes. And when he joined the resistance in 1943, not earlier, as he long maintained, he did it without repudiating his Vichy past, its ideology, or his friends, Payan writes. In short, the book contends, Mitterrand jumped ship when he felt the tide began to turn, a political decision, not a change of heart. As reviewer Philippe Rochette, R-O-C-H-E-T-T-E, put it in the left-leaning daily Libération, Mitterrand, quote, did not join the resistance, he slid gradually into it, unquote. And skipping down still further, although Mitterrand's sympathies with Pétain are well known, he gave up the practice of laying a commemorative wreath on his grave only after years of protests from Jewish groups. Few people were aware of his links with the extreme right. Also on record for the first time is Mitterrand's close friendship with René Bousquet, B-O-U-S-Q-U-E-T, Vichy's national police chief, who was responsible for the deportation of thousands of Jewish children. Bousquet was killed by a crazed gunman last year while awaiting trial for crimes against humanity. And in another interesting section of this article, in describing his fascist past, Payan quotes Mitterrand. Payan quoted Mitterrand as telling him, quote, in troubled times, especially when one is young, it is hard to make choices. I think I came out of it pretty well, unquote. Well, that may be Mitterrand's assistant, his assessment, rather. I'm not sure that I agree with his assessment of the situation. I would also note that Mitterrand said that in troubled times, especially when one is young, it is hard to make choices. Well, Mitterrand, for one, doesn't appear to have been able to identify Il Duce. Not when he was younger, anyway. He got religion a little later. What's worth noting, however, in this context, first of all, it is interesting and perhaps significant that François Mitterrand has a background of involvement with the French collaborationist fascist forces prior to and during World War II. Raises interesting questions about the bona fides of his current stance as a socialist. One wonders, and this is not a statement I'm making, but rather a question I'm asking, whether perhaps his fascist past is really as far behind him as he would like to have us believe. If France has collaborated very closely with Germany, and currently the French armed forces, the Navy in particular, are merging with those of Germany. One wonders to what extent the fascist past of François Mitterrand may have left him open to political blackmail and consequent manipulation. Last week we took a look at an article in which the proposed abduction of Nazi war criminal Gestapo chief and Lyon Gestapo chief and former U.S. intelligence operative Klaus Barbie was contemplated by Carlos the Jackal in order to embarrass Western governments with regard to their collaboration with war criminals. It's in light of the connections between François Mitterrand and the people involved with anti-resistance movement efforts, as well as the rounding up of the Jews, one has to wonder whether perhaps François Mitterrand himself was among those who may have been tarred by the Barbie brush, if in fact Klaus Barbie and or others involved with the French collaborationist effort during World War II had begun to talk as fully as they might have. Recall it was Klaus Barbie who is credited with the capture of French resistance leader Jean Moulin. There are a lot of questions about who may have betrayed Moulin, but Klaus Barbie certainly very closely connected with the French fascist forces that were involved against the resistance. One of the people involved with those anti-resistance forces of the fascist Vichy collaborationist government, obviously, was François Mitterrand, who was very close to some of those involved with squashing the resistance. And note also his close friendship with René Bousquet, the national police chief of Vichy. I wonder what Mr. Bousquet might have had to say if, in fact, an assassin's bullet had not stilled his tongue prematurely, at any rate. Note in particular that François Mitterrand was an associate of many of the leaders of La Cagoule and was closely tied with La Cagoule. Now, La Cagoule, along with the Croix de Fer, was a clandestine fascist group in pre-World War II France that actually attempted to overthrow the government of France. Specifically, reactionary elements in France were embittered by the Democratic Socialist Coalition under Léon Blum. It was a coalition government which ran the gamut from doctrinaire communists all the way through solidly established Democrats with a small d. Many of them were non-Marxist socialists as well. This government was elected to power largely as an anti-fascist government. It was regarded with deep contempt and deep hostility by many of the most prominent industrialists and financiers in France, the so-called 200 families who ran France, and also by political and national security figures allied with them. The Cagoule actually attempted to stage a fascist coup in France. It attempted to overthrow the legitimate democratically elected government of France in 1937 and 1938 in a fashion not unlike the abortive fascist coup in the United States in 1934, in which American industrialists and financiers who were embittered against Franklin Roosevelt attempted to overthrow Roosevelt and set up a corporate state along the line of Mussolini's fascist government in Italy. The Cagoule, in particular, operated clandestinely. Its members wore hoods. They were organized along cellular lines, small, clandestine groups. They were very heavily armed. And as we shall see, the Cagoule involved, many of the people involved with the Cagoule were very prominent French political and national security figures. And many of the participants in the unsuccessful Cagoule fascist coup attempt of 37 and 38 later became very prominent members of the Vichy collaborationist fascist government that worked with Adolf Hitler. And indeed, the overlap between the people involved with the Cagoule, this clandestine cellular fascist organization that almost overthrew the Social Front of Léon Blum, the connections between them and the Vichy government are profound. And beyond that, we should note that many of the French fascists allied with the Cagoule actively collaborated with the Germans in order to bring the French military to its knees. The French lost the war in 1940 through a combination of bungling and deliberate subversion by many of the fascists associated with the Cagoule and the Croix de Fer, who literally preferred Hitler and foreign-born fascists to domestic socialists and Democrats with a small d from their own country. Bear in mind in this context, Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf that I added as an addendum to Uncle Sam and the Swastika. Many prominent industrialists and financiers shared Hitler's view that democracy itself was subversive because it allowed inferior people to gain a certain amount of control over the means of production. We're going to take a look at the political milieu of which François Mitterrand was a part, and we're also going to take a look at the Cagoule in particular. We're going to take a look at the role of French fascism in attempting to overthrow the Social Front of Léon Blum. Later, we're going to take a look at the role played by graduates of the Cagoule in the actual subversion of France during the invasion by the Germans. As I said, the French lost the war through a combination of bungling and deliberate subversion. Many of those who were both bunglers and deliberately subversive were people associated with the Cagoule who later became prominent participants in the Vichy government. We're going to take a look at the milieu of François Mitterrand by beginning our discussion with an examination of the method, the operational methodology of Nazism itself. Now, bear in mind the material from Radio Free America number 10, and the miscellaneous archive show about the origins of the Nazi Party. Hitler, in his inception as a political animal, was an undercover agent for the political department of the German army under General von Lossow. He first infiltrated what became the German Nazi Party along with fellow undercover operatives and pan-German propagandists, many of them associated with the political department under General von Lossow. They infiltrated the German Nazi Party, or the German Socialist Workers' Party, which in its inception became a front for Reichswehr intelligence, for the generation of propaganda, and for the physical introduction of German military personnel into civilian society in order to effect political reaction. As we're going to see, the espionage agency origins of Adolf Hitler as a political animal and of the Nazi Party as a political entity have had a profound influence on the operational methodology of fascism. As I said in my introductory discussion, fascism in an operational sense, German Nazism in particular, functions essentially in the manner that intelligence agencies function in. One of the things that leads those who are unfamiliar with this type of research to demean it as conspiracy theory is a lack of familiarity with the functionings of fascism. It functions, Nazism in particular, functions clandestinely. It operates clandestinely. It engages in covert activities much the way an intelligence agency does. And it is also one of the reasons why intelligence agencies have become very fertile breeding grounds for fascism over the years. One of the best ways of learning to identify Il Duce is to read about Il Duce from the people that were writing about Il Duce and also Der Führer at the time when they were holding sway in the 1930s and 1940s. Of course, going back to the Examiner column, which is the keynote for this archive show, Johnny can't identify Il Duce and Janie can't identify Il Duce. One of the reasons is that people have not studied the history, and to a large extent, the history has been deliberately suppressed, both by those who did support Il Duce and Der Führer and don't want that known, and by those who would put over an agenda on contemporary citizens, like the agenda of Hitler and Mussolini. For our discussion of the cagoule, the political milieu of François Mitterrand in his fascist collaborationist days, and for an examination of the operational methodological tenets of German fascism, we're going to turn to two books that were written in the late 1930s and 1940s. This first book was by a prominent journalist named Joseph Gollum, G-O-L-L-O-M-B. Gollum achieved a lot of publicity at the time he was writing in the late 30s and 1940s for his excellent work covering the rise of fascism around the world. Joseph Gollum became one of the most noted anti-fascist writers in the 1930s and 1940s. He wrote a book about the operational methodologies of fascist subversion. That book was called Armies of Spies. Again, the author Joseph Gollum, G-O-L-L-O-M-B. This book was published in hardcover in 1939 by the Macmillan Company. So once again, Armies of Spies by Joseph Gollum, copyright 1939 in hardcover by the Macmillan Company. We're going to begin by taking a look at the operational methodology of German fascism, whether operating at home, i.e. in Germany, to subvert the democracy of the Weimar Republic, or, as we shall see, when operating in foreign countries such as neighboring France, the methodology used by Nazism to subvert democracy is essentially the same, whether it is operating in its home country, so to speak, to subvert democracy, or operating in a foreign country. And the clandestine, cellular nature of the organization is characteristic of Nazi methodology, and it is something that we will be seeing repeated throughout history, both in the pre-World War II, World War II, and post-World War II periods, an echo of that clandestine cellular methodological organization to be found in the clandestine anti-communist cells that were mandated as part of the original NATO treaty and which resulted in Operation Stay Behind, Gladio, the P2, ultimately in the succession to power, or the accession to power, of the MSI. Of Adolf Hitler and his inspiration for using clandestine warfare to achieve success for fascism, Joseph Gollum writes as follows in Armies of Spies. Hitler remembered how his hero, Frederick the Great, boasted that for every cook in his armies he had 100 spies. Bismarck, another of Hitler's heroes, prepared Prussia's invasion of France by sending ahead of his armies not 100 spies, but literally an army of them. 30,000 pairs of eyes and ears, men and women playing roles as peddlers and chambermaids, salesmen and prostitutes, shop clerks and secretaries, lawyers and clergy, frock-coated gentlemen and smartly owned and smartly gowned women to ply their charms, men to woo women in all walks of life, women to seduce men. 30,000 spies overran France in advance of the military and so undermined it that when the troops of Prussia marched into the country, it collapsed like a termite-ridden structure. On his hospital cot, Hitler pondered it all. There was the pattern to follow, he exulted. Recruit an army of spies, an army not only in numbers but in organization and discipline. At the same time, recruit another army in uniform. this one would have to live at first under some, quote, legal, unquote, guise, so that it would have a chance to grow to strike to grow to striking strength before the government became too alarmed. So in this discussion, and by the way, he's obviously extrapolating when he talks about on his cot, Hitler pondered it all. It is the belief of Joseph Gollum that Hitler actually formed his strategic methodology while he was recovering from a gas attack near the end of World War I. Beginning again, there was the pattern to follow, he exulted. Recruit an army of spies, an army not only in numbers but in organization and discipline. At the same time, recruit another army in uniform. This one would have to live at first under some, quote, legal, unquote, guise, so that it would have a chance to grow to striking strength before the government became too alarmed. Now, the clandestine cellular organizational nature of Nazism aims, basically, at permitting the overt, quote, legal, unquote, structures to grow to striking strength before the government becomes too alarmed, whether that is the government in the home country of German Nazism, the seat of the Weimar Republic in Germany, or whether it was a neighboring country. And this methodology, one that is inextricably linked with the methodology of intelligence services, is the methodology of fascism and also of fascist-connected intelligence services to this day. It is the methodology which ultimately we find reflected in the P2 Lodge of Licio Gelli, and the successful prosecution of his democratic rebirth strategy into the Berlusconi right-wing coalition, right-wing fascist coalition government of today. Continuing with Joseph Gollum's account from 1939 in Armies of Spies. But until the army in the open had attained full stature, the Secret Service Army must add to its function combatant service. It must sap and mine and undermine. Men drink in words as they drink water, a daily need from press and pulpit and personal hearsay. Then the reservoir from which the enemy drinks must be seen to. The foolish must be fooled, the discontented inflamed, by persuasion and by bribery, by threat, intrigue, blackmail, and lie, much can be done to the minds of a people. Meanwhile, good men must infiltrate every trench of the enemy, win posts high and low, so long as they are important posts. All this time, arms and ammunition must be begged, borrowed, or stolen, and cached in secret places until the proper moment. And every now and then, the two growing armies in concert must try a push at the edifice of the enemy. A putsch was Hitler's word for it, to see how ripe the moment may be. Note that one of the major functions of the clandestine fascist units, the clandestine fascist cells, and we're going to see more about those cells later on, is the spreading of propaganda and the effecting of psychological warfare. Indeed, the text here of Joseph Gollum is very similar in describing the political undermining, the agitprop, so to speak, agitation and propaganda to be engaged in by the clandestine Secret Service Army, as Gollum puts it. That is very similar to the principles of psychological warfare as set forth by the Chinese military philosopher Sun Tzu and as parroted by General Reinhard Gehlen, the aforementioned Nazi Eastern Front spy chief, in his autobiography, The Service. Subtitled, The Memoirs of General Reinhard Gehlen. So bear in mind, the intelligence/fascist methodology devised by Adolf Hitler, because the use of clandestine political cells for agitation and propaganda, as well as for clandestine warfare, assassination, bombing, sabotage, things of that kind, is a pattern that we are going to see throughout the evolution of fascism. It is the clandestine cellular espionage methodology of German fascism is one of the things that has permitted fascism to perpetuate itself and to do so to a large extent clandestinely and without the recognition of many people, many of the people in the world, including many people who will ultimately fall victim to that fascism. Later, Joseph Gollum describes the effect that Hitler's viewpoint had in changing the nature of spies. Now, I would stress here that Hitler didn't really do anything new so much as refining and formalizing and amplifying techniques which were already in existence. But Hitler, and his German Nazi party did indeed revamp the nature of espionage, and that revamping of both espionage and the individual nature of the spy described here by Joseph Gollum in 1939, writing in Armies of Spies. Before Hitler, too, a spy was usually, in the parlance of espionage, a mere letterbox, a thief of papers, a seducer of information to be passed on to a superior, and the job was done. In the time of war, of course, some spies were assigned to work destruction, rarely in time of peace. Today, the function of the spy is vastly enlarged. He works for destruction in time of peace, even though there is no declaration of war between his country and his victim. So much has his function changed that the term for modern espionage has also changed. It is now, quote, combatant secret service, unquote. How much has Hitler had to do with this change? Consider some figures. In 1932, the year before he took over Germany officially, there were 7 espionage trials in France. In 1937, 4 years after he took power, the number of espionage trials in France multiplied more than 20-fold to 148. In the 40 years between the outbreak of the Franco-Prussian War and 1920, fewer than 1,900 spies were caught in all the major countries of the world put together, and this includes the World War. In the ensuing 18 years, the number of spies caught in the same countries was 22 times as many as in the 40 years preceding. Not all spies are paid in cash, but a brief examination of Germany's budgets for Secret Service is illuminating. In 1909, according to a report made in the House of Commons, Germany spent the equivalent of $375,000 a month for Secret Service all over the world, counter-espionage in its own country included. By 1917 and 18, the budget for German espionage had risen to $6 million a month. But that was in a time of war. What Germany is spending today can be gathered only from indications, but figures laboriously gathered by those who cannot afford to be careless with them point to an expenditure by Germany of $8,640,000 a month for, quote, combatant secret service, unquote, in 7 countries only, and this at a time when Germany is officially, quote, at peace, unquote. So note again that the expansion of German espionage activity, in accordance with the methodology of infiltration and subversion that was refined and formalized by Adolf Hitler, that expansion of the espionage function and its projection forward into peacetime as a form of clandestine warfare, not mere, quote, spying, unquote, that resulted in the expansion of the number of spies caught in neighboring countries, the expansion in espionage total, and, of course, in the expansion of the German intelligence budget. What we're going to take a look at next is the French terminology for the small groups of spies that were to comprise an integral part of the Third Reich's and of fascist intelligence and political methodology. Take note also of the psychological warfare dissemination functions of many of these operatives, because this is something that was envisioned by Hitler in describing the way in which the so-called combatant secret services would psychologically undermine the populations that they were targeting, whether they're the populations of, say, Germany or Italy, or whether they're the populations of neighboring countries. Joseph Gollum writes again in Armies of Spies, but neither Italy nor Japan, and no other country in recorded history, has devoted to espionage so vast a portion of its national budgets as modern Germany has, nor developed it on so complicated a pattern and on so overwhelming a scale as Hitler has. And its achievements have been correspondingly impressive. It is history, for instance, that the war in Spain did not just happen to break out, nor has it been primarily a Spanish affair. For years it had been prepared by German sapper spies, or as the French call them, saboteurs. Then there were Austria and Czechoslovakia. Corresponding to the company unit, say in infantry, saboteur spies work in groupings which the French have named after the word for nest, need, N-I-D, or need, perhaps. The average need consists, again to use other terms the French have developed, of about 100 moutons, 80 dupeurs, and 20 baladours, all working under an agent fixe. Mouton specialize in industrial sabotage. Dupuy confined themselves to military and semi-military information and work. Balladurs, or strollers, are freelancers who go wherever their superior equipment prompts them to go. Unknown to any of the need are trafiquants, spies sent from Berlin to watch their own spies to see that there is efficiency and no graft or double-agent trafficking with the enemy. Saboteur spies are of two categories, quote, termites, unquote, and, quote, torpedoes, unquote, with a third category exclusively German known as harbor service, quote, unquote. Termites confine themselves to psychological work. They encourage disaffected individuals and groups, organizations, and inflammable minorities. They spread rumors that gnaw at a nation's credit structure, whispering campaigns against banks, and on stock exchanges. They circulate stories and analyses that breed worry. They distribute printed matter of all kinds and photographs that have either been specially staged or bear captions that do the work of disseminating despair. They subsidize newspapers with advertisements, copy, or outright cash. They try to do the same with radio and newsreels. Here, for example, is a typical termite circular that had wide circulation among the Arabs in French Morocco. Quote, "The Jew is devouring you as vermin devour sheep. France protects him. He is the agent and tool of France. Germany locks him up or drives him out or otherwise disposes of him. Germany confiscates the property of the Jews and thus adds to its national wealth. You could do the same, Moroccans, if you were not the slaves of France." Unquote. From 2 to 18 months after termites begin their work, the torpedoes move in. As their name would indicate, the character of their work is not, quote, psychological, unquote, but physical. They concentrate on key industries, lines of communication and transport, hydroelectric systems, power distribution lines, railroad terminals and centers, bridges, canals, aviation fields, airplane factories, ammunition works and arsenals, mines, and stored supplies of raw material and manufactured goods. So note that in addition to the usual work of espionage, ferreting out key strategic information, two of the main functions of the army of spies, devised by Adolf Hitler, as Joseph Gollum refers to it or has titled it, are to, first of all, conduct clandestine warfare, the actual physical sabotage of enemy installations and industrial sites, but also, in addition to actual clandestine warfare and sabotage, psychological work, i.e. psychological warfare, the spreading of information and disinformation to psychologically undermine the enemy and to psychologically undermine the body that is being targeted for conquest. Now, note again, a very important element of tonight's discussion, the methodology used by fascism in general, by German fascism and Nazism in particular, to subvert a government is essentially the same, whether it is being used domestically or in a foreign sense. The use of small clandestine bodies, small clandestine organizations, to agitate behind the scenes to spread psychological warfare and disinformation, to psychologically and politically undermine the body targeted, the body politic targeted for fascist takeover, as well as the physical sabotage of that society. That methodology is essentially the same, whether it is being directed against a foreign power or against democratic forces in one's own country. So the methodology of fascism in taking over Germany, both in the pre-World War II period and, as we shall see, in the contemporary period, is essentially the same methodology as fascism and Nazism used to subvert their neighbors, the use of small clandestine bodies for both clandestine warfare and psychological warfare. We're going to see that methodology employed over the decades. Now, again, it's important to understand that one of the ways that the Nazis were able to conquer many of the people they conquered, and this is described, by the way, in Radio Free America number 37, how the United States lost the Second World War, was by using anti-communism in a strategic fashion. One of the countries where anti-communism was used strategically with the greatest skill was in France. Now, in France, there was a very strong fascist political movement, which took several forms. Two of the main bodies were the Croix de Fer, or Cross of Fire, or Croix de Feu, excuse me, Cross of Fire, and also the Cagoulards, or the La Cagoule, or the Cagoulards, Les Cagoulards, the so-called hooded ones. Those were the hooded fascists that François Mitterrand was quite close to, and about whom we're going to hear more in just a couple of minutes. We should note that the French fascists were rallying to a large extent against the government of Léon Blum, the popular front or social front of Léon Blum, which in turn was coalesced to a large extent in reaction to the advent of French fascism. The willingness of French military and political figures to engage in subversion and to collaborate with German fascism in subverting their own country was due to a large extent to the anti-communist doctrine of fascism. Many of the French fascists who worked with the Cagoule, who collaborated with Hitler, and who became key elements of the Vichy government, and who, obviously, were working with François Mitterrand when he was of a similar political inclination, many of these elements felt much more comfortable about Adolf Hitler and about German fascists than about Democrats and socialists in their own nationality. So French fascism, by the way, I'm telescoping things to a certain extent in the interests of time. The growth of fascism in France, the subversive activities of the Cagoule, of Les Cagoulards, the attempted fascist coup of 37 and 38, the subversion of France and the Vichy collaboration is an enormous story, and one that unfortunately we haven't got time to go into this evening, so I'm necessarily telescoping some very profound and major political happenings into a relatively short period of time, so please bear with me under the circumstances. But French fascism, to a large extent, was created or grew in response to the social front of Léon Blum and the willingness of many of the French fascists to subvert their own country. And again, the Cagoulards actually engaged in an abortive fascist coup in the 1937-38 period, and their willingness to collaborate with the Nazis later was due to their anti-communist doctrine and their hatred of the democratically elected socialist coalition government of Léon Blum. Returning once again to Armies of Spies by Joseph Gollum from 1939. Gollum writes, fascism was rearing its head in France under the leadership of Colonel Casimir de la Roque, that's R-O-C-D-E-L-A, capital R-O-C-Q-U-E, who was openly aping Hitler and Mussolini. Rallying against the threat to their democracy, the people of France, from communists to the solidly middle-class radical socialists, formed the Front Populaire, went to the polls, and elected a potent majority united under Léon Blum, who became premier. The victory rendered desperate and ruthless the big industrialists and the, quote, 200 families, unquote, of France, who owned the bulk of France's wealth. So note again that in France there was a situation where the wealth of the nation was concentrated to a large extent, primarily in the hands of 200 families. Those 200 families represented the core of the sentiments on behalf of fascism, that sentiment expressing itself not only in the Cagoulard movement, the clandestine organization for a fascist coup in 37 and 38, but the later Vichy collaboration. What we're going to look at next is Joseph Gollum's description of the fascist agitation and of the clandestine coup attempt that was staged by the Cagoulards, the so-called Hooded Ones. Again, they were a clandestine French fascist organization that relied on small, highly organized clandestine groups, heavily armed, as we shall see, as their basic methodological foundation. The Cagoule's activities came to light in 1937 and 38 when the French police authorities staged a series of raids and came across all sorts of weapons caches, secret hideouts, secret fortresses, and they came upon these while investigating bombings and assassinations that had been performed by members of the Cagoule. Now, again, what we're looking at here, and bear in mind François Mitterrand's connections to the Cagoule and to the Cagoulard leaders, what we're looking at here is a coup attempt, very similar to the American fascist coup attempt of 1934, in which dissatisfied French industrialists, financiers, politicians, and national security people, meaning military officers, military leaders, attempted to overthrow the democratically elected government of Léon Blum because they were more sympathetic. They preferred fascism to democracy. Later, many of these same elements actively collaborated with the German invasion. And as we shall see, the Cagoule was basically allied with Hitler and Mussolini and represented a fifth column, an actual projection into France of the Third Reich's intelligence services and also the Italian intelligence services for the purposes of subverting their neighbor nation. And note the profound, note the pivotal role played by the domestic fascists, in this case the Cagoule, the Cagoulard, in this subversion effort by Italy and Germany. The description of the Cagoule, and by the way, La Cagoule was the organization, the Cagoulard were the members of that organization. In describing the Cagoulard fascist coup attempt of 1937 and 38, Joseph Gollum writes as follows. The witch's cauldron of blood and dynamite was still simmering when on October 16th, a new melodrama began on National Highway No. 5 that runs from Geneva to Paris. Two Swiss customs officers were patrolling that road at Curet, C-U-R-E-T, when from around the bend came a black coupe converted into a commercial vehicle. The car swerved into the curve so fast that one of the rear doors flew open and then in the straightaway it closed again. When the customs officer came to this curve, they saw a trail of rifle cartridges in the road. By this time, the car was well into French territory, and the customs officers, telephoned ahead. At a filling station, the coupe was stopped by French police and searched. It was full of ammunition for small arms. The driver and only occupant was taken to police headquarters for questioning. He gave his name readily, Fernand Jacoubiez, J-A-K-U-B-I-E-Z, or Jacoubier. It took pressure, however, to make him answer more searching questions. Quote, where are you taking all that ammunition? Unquote. To the Villa La Futé in Rueil, R-U-E-I-L, a suburb of Paris, he finally replied. Jacoubier was not allowed to send out word of his arrest, and the Sûreté Nationale converged on the Villa La Futé. The house was owned by a Lucien Lenoir, L-E-N-O-I-R, but the man who lived in it called himself Louis-Joseph Malicone, M-A-L-L-I-C-O-N-E. The tenant looked profoundly disturbed when plainclothes men swarmed into La Futé, but he protested they would find nothing in the house to warrant, quote, outrageous intrusion, unquote. Two of the intruders kept him company in the living room. The rest explored the house from garret to cellar. Down below, at the end of a narrow hallway, they came to a wall of shelves of bottled wine. They probed about and found a hidden door, which they opened. Their flashlights revealed a large square chamber with walls of reinforced concrete to which were fastened iron rings and strong chains, obviously a prison. In the wall opposite the entrance was another door with a peephole. This door had to be pried open with steel. It was made of metal, but finally gave way. The room into which it opened was much longer than the other and was lined with rows of cots. At first, the searchers thought it was a dormitory. Then it was intended as an infirmary. There were glass cabinets full of surgical instruments, medical supplies, and, incongruous in a sick room, racks of loaded revolvers. The landlord and the caretaker of the villa stubbornly denied that they knew anything about these rooms. The police tried another tack. Those interesting rooms, they decided, with their massive, specially constructed walls of reinforced concrete, were not built by some inexperienced provincial mason. A swift nationwide hunt found André Vasselin, V-A-S-S-E-L-I-N, of 13 Rue Bettencourt at Dieppe, who admitted he had worked on the masonry job at La Futé. He, too, was questioned, and this time to some effect. It was my boss, Monsieur Anceau, A-N-C-A-U-X, who ordered me to do that work, unquote. Anceau was arrested. His business, that of a building contractor, proved no clue to his interest in the Villa Via La Futé, but his political affiliation was more illuminating. He was a former leader of the local chapter of Colonel de la Roque's fascist organ, Croix de Feu, that's Cross of Fire. Again, that's one of the two dominant fascist organizations in France, along with the Cagoule, a considerable degree of overlap between them.